The election of John Adams to the presidency back in 1796 and the quasi-war with France that followed seemed, at the time, to have marked the nadir of the Republicans' fortunes. Even though Thomas Jefferson, as Adams's unwilling vice president, would preside over the Senate, Jefferson himself was certain that Adams intended to exclude him from participating in the administration as much as possible. And Jefferson expected that the Constitution will know me only as the member of a legislative body. No one felt the discouragement of the Republicans in 1796 more than James Madison. From his position as the de facto floor leader of the opposition, he had been forced to watch as, one by one, Alexander Hamilton's plans were implemented, as George Washington became increasingly chilly and distant, and as Madison's own influence gradually declined. The Jay Treaty was so full of shameful concessions, of mock reciprocities, and of party artifices that no other circumstances than the peculiar ones which mark our present political situation could screen it from universal execration. Washington was completely in the snares of the British faction and is laboring to rear every obstruction as well as to remove every facility to an improvement of our commercial relations with France. There seemed no point in protesting that the bill for establishing a national bank was not warranted by the Constitution, since there were other members of the Constitutional Convention sitting in the same House who insisted exactly the opposite. An awful scene seems to be opening upon us, Madison wrote to Jefferson. In December of 1796, he decided not to seek re-election to Congress and stayed in Virginia for the next 4 years, tending to the affairs of his increasingly frail father and speculating in Western land. The one bright spot was the end of his long bachelorhood and his sublimely happy marriage to the vivacious widow, Dolly Payne Todd, in September 1794. However, the sudden collapse of Federalist political fortunes in the last 2 years of the Adams administration and the election of Thomas Jefferson to the presidency, what Jefferson liked to call the Revolution of 1800, seemed suddenly to have brought the sun from behind the clouds. The day after his inauguration, Jefferson offered Madison the post of Secretary of State, and together they planned a rule of conduct for undoing the enormities of Alexander Hamilton and restoring strict republicanism. Madison even dressed the part of the virtuous Commonwealth's man. "I never knew him to wear any other color than black," wrote Dolly's cousin, Edward Coles. "His coat being cut in what is termed dress fashion, his breeches short with buckles at the knees, black silk stockings, and shoes with strings, or long, fair-top boots when out in cold weather. He wore powder on his hair, which was dressed full over the ears, tied behind, and brought to a point above the forehead to cover in some small degree his baldness." Together with Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, the three men saw themselves as a sort of Roman triumvirate, called to rescue the Republic from the grasping hands of would-be aristocrats. Madison's day-to-day responsibilities as Secretary of State were more humdrum. Passports, diplomatic correspondence, ships' cargo manifests, filing patents. "I find myself in the midst of arrears of papers, etc., etc., which little accord with my unsettled health," he sighed. And apart from the triumph of the Louisiana Purchase, which he thought a truly noble acquisition, Madison's chief problem was how to deal with British arrogance on the high seas. He composed a densely thought-out treatise, an examination of the British doctrine which subjects to capture a neutral trade, in 1805. But treatises were little answer to the broadsides of HMS Leopard. And rather than face the prospect of outright war with Britain, Madison not only endorsed Jefferson's embargo, but spared no pains to stop every leak by which the effect of the embargo law might be diminished. What surprised Madison was how little credit he and Jefferson and Gallatin received for their labors. The eccentric John Randolph of Roanoke, as the new floor leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives and chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, denounced the Louisiana Purchase, denounced Madison's interest in land speculation, and denounced nearly everything else Jefferson's administration did as apostasies from true, pure republicanism. And Randolph gathered around him a dissident Republican faction known only as the Tertium Quid, Latin, which is translated simply as the third something or other. Yet another faction, formed this time from Anglophobe congressmen from the Western frontier, blamed Jefferson and Madison for doing too little to punish the great British Satan. Their most talented figurehead was the Virginia-born Henry Clay, who was outraged that the injuries we have received from Great Britain remain unredressed. He was the Warhawk's chief and inevitable leader, and his answer to the British menace was always, "Annex Canada." "I am for resistance by the sword," said Clay in his first speech to Congress. "The conquest of Canada is in your power." Of course, you might think, given the United States Army, that might have been an overreach. "But," Clay resumed, "I trust I shall not be deemed presumptuous when I state what I verily believe, that the militia are alone competent to place Montreal and Upper Canada at your feet. Is it nothing to us to extinguish the torch that lights up savage warfare? Is it nothing to acquire the entire fur trade connected with that country and to destroy the temptation and the opportunity of violating your revenue and other laws?" But neither Randolph's Tertium Quids nor Clay's Warhawks could assemble enough political mass to control the administration successfully. So when Jefferson wearily announced that his second term as president would also be his last, and that he would be shaking off the shackles of power for the tranquil pursuits of science, the Republican Congressional Caucus gave Madison its blessing as the next Republican nominee for the presidency. And he won handsomely, collecting 122 electoral votes against the meager 47 won by his Federalist opponent and former colleague from the Constitutional Convention, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. What was easy to miss was that the Federalist vote had improved by 30% over the 1804 election, and that New England turned out en bloc to vote for Pinckney, and that Federalist candidates for Congress picked up 24 new seats. Madison was less worried about the Federalists than he was by the Warhawks of his own party. No one felt less love for the British than Madison, but he feared the consequences of a war with the greatest naval power on earth, and he was determined not to be dictated to by the upstart Henry Clay. Despite the appearance of submission to foreign edicts, Madison allowed the embargo to expire, which was replaced by a much weaker Non-Intercourse Act. Unhappily for Madison, the British clumsily undid every one of his efforts to maintain a respectable peace. Madison had hardly taken office as president in the spring of 1809, when the new British minister in Washington City, David Erskine, unrolled a new British policy initiative that offered to mollify American grievances over the Chesapeake Leopard incident, including the surrender of three of the seamen seized off the Chesapeake's deck, and to secure non-interference with American trade on the seas. Madison was delighted at this offer, And Congress promptly and jubilantly dropped the new military appropriations bill it had been mulling over. However, the congratulations which flowed to Madison for this diplomatic coup were premature. Erskine, who had an American wife and was eager to placate American interests, had exceeded his instructions from London. And when the news of the agreements reached the desk of the British Foreign Minister, George Canning, they were angrily repudiated as the work of a Scotch flunky. Following spring, it was the turn of the French minister to present an offer from Bonaparte, which in like manner proposed to ease French harassment of American trade. Madison took Bonaparte at his word and reinstated an embargo on trade with Britain. To Madison's embarrassment, Bonaparte then insisted that his offer could not be fully implemented. Once again, Madison looked like he had been played with by a European power. While these diplomatic insults boxed the American Republic on one ear, two major military crises in 1811 boxed it on the other. The first of these crises was the Tecumseh Confederation, an alliance of Indian tribes under the dual leadership of the Shawnee, Tecumseh, and his brother, Tenskwatawa, which threatened to light the entire Northwest Territory in a blaze of Indian warfare. The Warhawks treated this as nothing but a stalking horse for British recolonization of America and only redoubled their demands for war with Britain and invasion of Canada. The second crisis was the clash between the American frigate, President, and the British sloop of war, Little Belt. In the spring of 1811, a small flotilla of British warships, headed by the large frigate, Guerriere, once again began stopping and searching American ships just outside New York Harbor. The frigate, President, was sent to warn the British off. And on the evening of May 16, 1811, the President overhauled and challenged a British ship, which the President's captain mistook in the darkness for the British Guerriere. The British ship, which turned out to be the 18-gun sloop Little Belt, replied with a cannon shot. And as if to wipe out the disgrace of the Chesapeake, the President poured two broadsides into her and left her a wallowing hulk in 15 minutes. The British demanded that the captain of the President be court-martialed. But instead of punishing the President's captain, Americans cheered the attack on the Little Belt as proof that the American Navy was fully capable of standing up to the British in combat. Are we upon the eve of a declaration of our independence upon Great Britain being repeated, not by the pen or by a general suffrage, but by the mouths of our cannon? Asked the old revolutionary Benjamin Rush at the end of August 1811. Old Light Horse Harry Lee, who had stood shoulder to shoulder with Madison in the Virginia Ratifying Convention 24 years before, confronted Madison with a demand that Madison take us out of the odious condition of half war by drawing the sword. In mid-May, the Republican Congressional Caucus met to select the Republican presidential nominee for the elections in the fall of 1812. And led by Henry Clay, the caucus plainly told Madison that his being supported as the party candidate for the next presidency depended upon his screwing his courage to a declaration of war. On June 1st, Madison finally yielded. He sent a message to Congress, reviewing the sorry tales of American seamen dragged on board ships of war of a foreign nation and exposed under the severities of their discipline to be exiled to the most distant and deadly climes, to risk their lives in battles of their oppressors, of pretended blockades and the monopoly which she covets for her own commerce, of forgeries and perjuries, of warfare just renewed by the savages on one of our extended frontiers. And on that basis, he asked Congress for a declaration of war against Great Britain. The House responded promptly with a 79-49 vote in favor of the Declaration. Federalists in the Senate slowed the measure down, but they could not stop it. And the war bill passed the Senate 19-13 on June 17th. It was a far from resounding affirmation, but the next day Madison signed it. It was also a national catastrophe. The United States was no better prepared to go to war against England than it had been to go to war against the Pasha of Tripoli. Only now they were squaring off against the most powerful empire on the globe. The War of 1812 has become one of the most obscure of American wars, and with good reason, since there's a lot in it we can only look back upon with regret. For one thing, the Royal Navy possessed 219 ships of the line and 296 frigates. The United States had 5 frigates and a flock of sloops, schooners, and privateers. Gulliver, snorted John Adams from retirement, might bury it in the deep by making water on it. Some feverish pre-war preparations had set the size of the United States Army at 10,000 men. But by the time of the declaration of war, only 6,750 had been recruited. And most of them were doomed to be officered by senile holdovers from the Revolution. And then there was the ballyhoo about seizing Canada. Admittedly, Upper Canada was thinly settled, hardly more than 50,000 immigrants from Britain and former American loyalists. And the entire British garrison for Canada counted no more than 5,600 regular British infantry. Even so, there was a serious political disconnect between declaring war in defense of free trade and sailors' rights, but then launching a land invasion of Canada. If you have a field to defend in Georgia, asked Josiah Quincy, it would be very strange to put up a fence in Massachusetts. And yet how does this differ from invading Canada for the purpose of defending our maritime rights? That is, supposing such an invasion were even practicable. And it certainly gave no cheer to Republican hearts when Albert Gallatin announced that the war should be financed by excise taxes. Exactly the hated taxes that had triggered the Whiskey Rebellion and which Jefferson had eliminated. As it was, Canada turned out to be a more difficult nut to crack than anyone had imagined. Madison's Secretary of War, William Eustace, drew up a comprehensive plan for invading Canada with 3 separate forces crossing over into Upper Canada from Fort Detroit, into the Niagara Peninsula, and into Lower Canada from Plattsburgh, New York, to capture Montreal. It fizzled ingloriously. The creaking commander of the invasion of Upper Canada, William Hull, had last commanded troops in action in 1779. He managed briefly to get across the Detroit River in July of 1812, only to lose heart after a number of small-scale skirmishes, and retreated back to Fort Detroit, where he was besieged by British regulars under Major General Isaac Brock, and finally surrendered to Brock on August 16th without firing a shot in resistance. The invasion of the Niagara Peninsula got underway in October, but met with a bloody nose at the Battle of Queenston Heights, and thereafter degenerated into quarrels over seniority between the titular American commander, Stephen Van Rensselaer of the New York Militia, and Alexander Smythe, a regular army brigadier general who refused to take orders from a mere militiaman. The invasion of Lower Canada went the same dismal way. Jefferson's former Secretary of War, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn, who had been appointed the senior major general of the U.S. Army, lurched not toward Montreal, but across Lake Ontario to attack York, now modern-day Toronto, the capital of Upper Canada, in April of 1813. The militia got out of hand and burned the public buildings there to no particular purpose. and then a month later, abandoned it. Prostrated by typhoid fever, Dearborn resigned his commission in July. To the disappointment of the War Hawks, while the invasion of Canada spluttered, it was the Navy, the embodiment of the cause of free trade and sailors' rights, which won the laurels. Oliver Hazard Perry, a Navy lieutenant, set out to take charge of the tiny base at Presque Isle on Lake Erie in March 1813, managed to build a flotilla of 10 small ships led by two 20-gun brigs, Lawrence and Niagara, and took them out onto Lake Erie to challenge a British lake squadron of six medium-sized ships under a veteran of Trafalgar, Robert Barclay. Perry ran up his pennant on board Lawrence, along with a blue flag bearing the white-lettered motto, "Don't give up the ship." These had been the dying words of Captain James Lawrence, captain of the ill-fated frigate Chesapeake, which had been captured by HMS Shannon earlier that summer. Perry found the British squadron off Put-in Bay on September 10th and cleared for action. The British initially had the upper hand, pummeling the Lawrence and forcing Perry to transfer his command and flag to the Niagara. But Perry's ship handling was impeccable, and after 3 hours, the British ship surrendered. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours," Perry jubilantly reported. Nor was Lake Erie the only surprising victory for the U.S. Navy in this overmatched war. The frigate Constitution, one of the six frigates laid down at the time of the Quasi-War, met and captured the British frigate Guerriere in single combat off Halifax in August 1812, and sank the British frigate Java the following December. Yet another of the Quasi-War frigates, United States, captured the British frigate Macedonian in October 1812, and the sloop Hornet captured the British sloop Peacock the next year. But these were only pinpricks, and pinpricks in the hide of a Royal Navy whose resources were thinly stretched everywhere around the globe in Britain's death struggle with Bonaparte. When the American frigate Essex not only captured the British sloop Alert and then bagged 15 British merchantmen as prizes, the Royal Navy turned a full squadron loose in pursuit and cornered the Essex and sank her off the coast of Chile. Nor did the Navy's frigates do much to compensate for American failures on land. In 1814, a freshly reorganized American army, commanded by Major General Jacob Brown, once again crossed into the Niagara Peninsula, and this time soundly defeated the British at Chippewa on July 5th, and fought them to a bloody draw at Lundy's Lane, 4 miles away, on July 25th. But Brown, who had been wounded in the fighting, had no resources with which to exploit these achievements. And in 3 weeks, the American invasion was back more or less where it had begun. What was worse, Napoleon, who had drained his own vast resources fighting wars in Spain and Russia, had finally been cornered, defeated, and exiled to the Mediterranean island of Elba, thus freeing up British troops and British ships to undertake their own offensive campaigns against the American coastline. In a campaign of revenge for the destruction of York, a combined British naval and army expedition under the command of Vice Admiral Alexander Cochrane and Major General Robert Ross lunged up the Chesapeake Bay, landing 4,000 infantry, the 4th, 21st, 44th, and 85th Regiments of Foot, fresh from the campaigns against Napoleon, plus a corps of colonial marines composed of fugitive slaves who had been recruited by the British to fight their former masters. Cochrane, who had lost a brother at Yorktown, despised Americans. "They are a whining, canting race, much like the Spaniel, and require the same treatment. They must be drubbed into good manners." Cochrane prepared to administer that drubbing by landing at Benedict on the Patuxent River, brushing aside a hastily assembled American defense force at Bladensburg, Maryland, and descending on Washington City itself, where on August 24th, the British burned the Executive Mansion, the Capitol, the Treasury, and every other public building except the Patent Office and the headquarters of the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And they spared that only because the British were using it as a command post. "You may thank old Madison for this," crowed Sir George Cockburn, who had supervised the landing operations, to anyone left in Washington to listen. And before setting torch to the Executive Mansion, Cockburn sat down to a dinner which had been left on President Madison's table. He toasted Jemmy's health and added pleasantries about Dolly Madison, too vulgar to repeat. The whole fiasco might have been worse still if the British had, as they planned, managed to add the city of Baltimore to their bag. But an unexpectedly stout defense, put up by Major George Armistead and the garrison of Fort McHenry, guarding Baltimore Harbor, forced them to abandon any more ambitious efforts to occupy the Chesapeake Bay. And at least the defense of Fort McHenry and the enormous garrison flag which flew over its ramparts during the attack and is now the gem among all the Smithsonian Museum's collections provided the inspiration for the most heroic moment of the War of 1812, the poem which became the national anthem, Francis Scott Key's The Star-Spangled Banner. "I believe," predicted Sir George Cockburn, "that Mr. Madison will have to put on his armor and fight it out. I see nothing else." Cockburn earnestly hoped that he could capture Madison during the attack on Washington and carry him to England for a curiosity. But Madison went no nearer the fighting than a hilltop above Bladensburg. Dolly Madison was the more aggressive, furiously gathering up the Executive Mansion's treasures, including Gilbert Stuart's full-length portrait of George Washington, and sending them to safety. The truth was that James Madison had simply lost heart. Old Rufus King was incensed that the man he had watched take down every detail the Constitutional Convention offered back in 1787 now seemed to have no plan for prosecuting the war, none for the restoration of the public credit. "Our rulers can neither make war nor conclude peace." Madison's vice president, the splenetic Elbridge Gerry, died of an internal hemorrhage on his way to preside over the Senate. In Hartford, Connecticut, an ad hoc convention of New England Federalists met in December 1814, full of angry and malevolent talk about amending the Constitution to ban embargoes, impose presidential term limits, and prevent easy declarations of war. Madison was relieved beyond description when, in February of 1815, the British offered to end the war on a return to the pre-war status quo. Like Jefferson, Madison would accept no third term. And in the last weeks of his presidency, Madison's Secretary of the Navy thought, "The president never seemed so happy as now." Federalism had been destroyed by its cockpit of personalities, starting with Hamilton. But at least, it had had all the bright ideas on its side. The Republicans, and the anti-Federalists before them, had the great personalities, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Luther Martin. But the War of 1812 had exposed the shallowness of their intellectual roots. Contemptuous of commerce and manufacturing, they had taken the Republic into a war that required quite a good deal in terms of commerce and manufacturing. Impatient of the mechanics of debt and credit and filled with venom toward banks, they came up short of money to finance the war and were forced to turn in 1814 to private financiers, John Jacob Astor, David Parish, Stephen Girard, to guarantee the loans necessary to keep the wartime treasury solvent. Our commerce was put in fetters by non-importation acts and embargoes, mourned John Pendleton Kennedy. And the crisis that succeeded found us without the most ordinary resources of an independent people. Our armies went to the frontier clothed in the fabrics of the enemy. Our munitions of war were gathered as chance supplied them from the four quarters of the earth. And the whole struggle was marked by the prodigality, waste, and privation of a thriftless nation, taken at unawares and challenged to a contest without the necessary armor of a combatant. We saw around us a nation of 8 millions of people, possessed of a territory nearly equal to the continent of Europe, and yet, complained Kennedy, deranged in all its channels of industry, exhausted, and on the verge of bankruptcy. Nothing but the most perverse neglect of the fundamental precepts connected with the proper administration of the concerns of a commonwealth could have produced such a result. James Madison departed from the capital of the government he had done so much to create a month after the inauguration of his successor, James Monroe. There would be no other veterans of the Constitutional Convention to fill his office, no more survivors of the Continental or Confederation Congresses that had given birth to independence. It was the end of the age of the founders.